prompted apologetically. "Yeah," said Stan, still rubbing his chest. "Yeah, that's right. Very close to you-know-who, they say. Anyway, when little Harry Potter got the better of you-know-who..." Harry nervously flattened his bangs down again. "All you-know-who's supporters was tracked down, wasn't they, Ern? Most of them knew it was all over with you-know-who gone, and they came quiet. But not Sirius Black. I heard he thought he'd be second in command once you-know-who had taken over. Anyway, they cornered Black in the middle of a street full of muggles, and Black took out his wand, and he blasted half the street apart, and a wizard got it, and so did a dozen muggles what got in the way. Horrible, eh? And you know what Black did then?"
Stan continued in a dramatic whisper.
"What?" said Harry. "Laughed," said Stan. "Just stood there and laughed. And when reinforcements from the Ministry of Magic got there, he went with them, quiet as anything, still laughing his head off. 'Cause he's mad, isn't he, Ern? Isn't he mad? If he weren't when he went to Azkaban, he will be now," said Ern in his slow voice. "I'd blow myself up before I set foot in that place. Serves him right. Mind you, after what he did..." "They had a job covering it up, didn't they, Ern?" Stan said. "Old street blown up and all them muggles dead. What was it they said had happened, Ern?"
"Gas explosion," grunted Ernie.
"And now he's out," said Stan, examining the newspaper picture of Black's gaunt face again. "Never been a breakout from Azkaban before, has there, Ern? Beats me how he did it. Frightening, eh? Mind, I don't fancy his chances against them Azkaban guards, eh, Ern?" Ernie suddenly shivered.
"Talk about summer else, Stan, there's a good lad. Them Azkaban guards give me the collywobbles."
Stan put the paper away reluctantly, and Harry leaned against the window of the night bus, feeling worse than ever. He couldn't help imagining what Stan might be telling his passengers in a few nights' time.
"Hear about that Harry Potter? Blew up his aunt. We had him here on the night bus, didn't we, Ern? He was trying to run for it."
Harry had broken wizard law, just like Sirius Black. Was inflating Aunt Marge bad enough to land him in Azkaban? Harry didn't know anything about the wizard prison, though everyone he'd ever heard speak of it did so in the same fearful tone. Hagrid, the Hogwarts gamekeeper, had spent 2 months there only last year. Harry wouldn't soon forget the look of terror on Hagrid's face when he had been told where he was going, and Hagrid was one of the bravest people Harry knew. The night bus rolled through the darkness, scattering bushes and wastebaskets, telephone booths and trees, and Harry lay restless and miserable on his feather bed. After a while, Stan remembered that Harry had paid for hot chocolate, but poured it all over Harry's pillow when the bus moved abruptly from Anglesey to Aberdeen. One by one, wizards and witches in dressing gowns and slippers descended from the upper floors to leave the bus. They all looked very pleased to go. Finally, Harry was the only passenger left.
"Right then, Neville," said Stan, clapping his hands. "Whereabouts in London?"
"Diagon Alley," said Harry.
"Right-o," said Stan. "Hold tight then."
Bang! They were thundering along Charing Cross Road. Harry sat up and watched buildings and benches squeezing themselves out of the night bus's way. The sky was getting a little lighter. He would lie low for a couple of hours, go to Gringotts the moment it opened, then set off. Where? He didn't know. Ern slammed on the brakes, and the night bus skidded to a halt in front of a small and shabby-looking pub, the Leaky Cauldron, behind which lay the magical entrance to Diagon Alley.
"Thanks," Harry said to Ern.
He jumped down the steps and helped Stan lower his trunk and Hedwig's cage onto the pavement.
"Well," said Harry, "bye then."
But Stan wasn't paying attention. Still standing in the doorway to the bus, he was goggling at the shadowy entrance to the Leaky Cauldron.
"There you are, Harry," said a voice.
Before Harry could turn, he felt a hand on his shoulder. At the same time, Stan shouted,
"Blimey, Ern! Come here! Come here!"
Harry looked up at the owner of the hand on his shoulder and felt a bucket full of ice cascade into his stomach. He had walked right into Cornelius Fudge, the Minister of Magic himself. Stan leapt onto the pavement beside them.
"What did you call Neville, Minister?"
he said excitedly. Fudge, a portly little man in a long pinstripe cloak, looked cold and exhausted.
"Neville?"
he repeated, frowning.
"This is Harry Potter." "I knew it!"
Stan shouted gleefully.
"Ern, guess who Neville is, Ern? He's Harry Potter. I can see his scar."
"Yes," said Fudge testily. "Well, I'm very glad the night bus picked Harry up, but he and I need to step inside the leaky cauldron now."
Fudge increased the pressure on Harry's shoulder, and Harry found himself being steered inside the pub. A stooping figure bearing a lantern appeared through the door behind the bar. It was Tom, the wizened, toothless landlord.
"You've got him, Minister," said Tom. "Will you be wanting anything? Beer? Brandy?"
"Perhaps a pot of tea,"
said Fudge, who still hadn't let go of Harry. There was a loud scraping and puffing from behind them, and Stan and Ern appeared, carrying Harry's trunk and Hedwig's cage, and looking around excitedly.
"How come you didn't tell us who you are, eh, Neville?"
said Stan, beaming at Harry, while Ernie's owlish face peered interestedly over Stan's shoulder.
"And a private parlour, please, Tom," said Fudge pointedly.
"Bye," Harry said miserably to Stan and Ern, as Tom beckoned Fudge toward the passage that led from the bar.
"Bye, Neville," called Stan.
Fudge marched Harry along the narrow passage after Tom's lantern, and then into a small parlour. Tom clicked his fingers, a fire burst into life in the grate, and he bowed himself out of the room.
"Sit down, Harry," said Fudge, indicating a chair by the fire.
Harry sat down, feeling goosebumps rising up his arms despite the glow of the fire. Fudge took off his pinstripe cloak and tossed it aside, then hitched up the trousers of his bottle-green suit and sat down opposite Harry.
"I am Cornelius Fudge, Harry, the Minister of Magic."
Harry already knew this, of course. He had seen Fudge once before, but as he had been wearing his father's invisibility cloak at the time, Fudge wasn't to know that. Tom, the innkeeper, reappeared, wearing an apron over his nightshirt and bearing a tray of tea and crumpets. He placed the tray on a table between Fudge and Harry and left the parlour, closing the door behind him.
"Well, Harry," said Fudge, pouring out tea. "You've had us all in a right flap, I don't mind telling you. Running away from your aunt and uncle's house like that, I started to think. But you're safe, and that's what matters."
Fudge buttered himself a crumpet and pushed the plate toward Harry.
"Eat, Harry. You look dead on your feet. Now then, you will be pleased to hear that we have dealt with the unfortunate blowing up of Miss Marjorie Dursley. Two members of the Accidental Magic Reversal Department were dispatched to Privet Drive a few hours ago. Miss Dursley has been punctured, and her memory has been modified. She has no recollection of the incident at all, so that's that, and no harm done."
Fudge smiled at Harry over the rim of his teacup, rather like an uncle surveying a favourite nephew. Harry, who couldn't believe his ears, opened his mouth to speak, couldn't think of anything to say, and closed it again.
"You're worrying about the reaction of your aunt and uncle," said Fudge. "Well, I won't deny that they are extremely angry, Harry, but they are prepared to take you back next summer, as long as you stay at Hogwarts for the Christmas and Easter holidays."
Harry unstuck his throat.
"I always stay at Hogwarts for the Christmas and Easter holidays," he said, "and I don't ever want to go back to Privet Drive."
Now, I'm sure you'll feel differently once you've calmed down," said Fudge in a worried tone. "They are your family, after all, and I'm sure you are fond of each other. Very deep down."
It didn't occur to Harry to put Fudge right. He was still waiting to hear what was going to happen to him now.
"So all that remains," said Fudge, now buttering himself a second crumpet, "is to decide where you're going to spend the last 2 weeks of your vacation. I suggest you take a room here at the Leaky Cauldron, and..."
"Hang on," blurted Harry. "What about my punishment?"
Fudge blinked.
"Punishment?"
"I broke the law," Harry said. "The decree for the restriction of underage wizardry."
"Oh, my dear boy, we're not going to punish you for a little thing like that," cried Fudge, waving his crumpet impatiently. "It was an accident. We don't send people to Azkaban just for blowing up their aunts."
But this didn't tally at all with Harry's past dealings with the Ministry of Magic. "Last year I got an official warning just because a house elf smashed a pudding in my uncle's house," he told Fudge, frowning. "The Ministry of Magic said I'd be expelled from Hogwarts if there was any more magic there." Unless Harry's eyes were deceiving him, Fudge was suddenly looking awkward.
"Circumstances change, Harry. We have to take into account, in the present climate, surely you don't want to be expelled?"
"Of course I don't," said Harry.
"Well then, what's all the fuss about?" laughed Fudge. "Now have a crumpet, Harry, while I go and see if Tom's got a room for you."
Fudge strode out of the parlour, and Harry stared after him. There was something extremely odd going on. Why had Fudge been waiting for him at the Leaky Cauldron, if not to punish him for what he'd done? And now Harry came to think of it, surely it wasn't usual for the Minister of Magic himself to get involved in matters of underage magic. Fudge came back, accompanied by Tom, the innkeeper.
"Room 11's free, Harry," said Fudge. "I think you'll be very comfortable. Just one thing, and I'm sure you'll understand. I don't want you wandering off into Muggle London, all right? Keep to Diagon Alley, and you're to be back here before dark each night. Sure you'll understand. Tom will be keeping an eye on you for me."
"Okay," said Harry slowly, "but why..."
"Don't want to lose you again, do we?" said Fudge, with a hearty laugh. "No, no. Best we know where you are. I mean..."
Fudge cleared his throat loudly and picked up his pinstripe cloak.
"Well, I'll be off. Plenty to do, you know."
"Have you had any luck with Black yet?" Harry asked. Fudge's fingers slipped on the silver fastenings of his cloak.
"What's that? Oh, you've heard. Well, no, not yet, but it's only a matter of time. The Azkaban guards have never yet failed, and they are angrier than I've ever seen them."
Fudge shuddered slightly.
"So, I'll say goodbye."
He held out his hand, and Harry, shaking it, had a sudden idea.
Minister, can I ask you something?"
"Certainly,"
said Fudge with a smile. "Well, third years at Hogwarts are allowed to visit Hogsmeade, but my aunt and uncle didn't sign the permission form. Do you think you could..." Fudge was looking uncomfortable.
He said, no, I'm very sorry, Harry, but as I'm not your parent or guardian..."
"But you're the Minister of Magic," said Harry eagerly. "If you gave me permission..."
"No, I'm sorry, Harry, but rules are rules," said Fudge flatly. "Perhaps you'll be able to visit Hogsmeade next year. In fact, I think it's best if you don't. Yes, well, I'll be off. Enjoy your stay, Harry."
And with the last smile and shake of Harry's hand, Fudge left the room. Tom now moved forward, beaming at Harry.
"If you'll follow me, Mr. Potter," he said, "I've already taken your things up."
Harry followed Tom up a handsome wooden staircase to a door with a brass number 11 on it, which Tom unlocked and opened for him. Inside was a very comfortable-looking bed, with highly polished oak furniture, a cheerfully crackling fire, and, perched on top of the wardrobe...
"Hedwig!" Harry gasped.
The snowy owl clicked her beak and fluttered down onto Harry's arm.
"Very smart owl you've got there," chuckled Tom. "Arrived about 5 minutes after you did. If there's anything you need, Mr. Potter, don't hesitate to ask."
He gave another bow and left. Harry sat on his bed for a long time, absent-mindedly stroking Hedwig. The sky outside the window was changing rapidly from deep, velvety blue to cold, steely grey, and then slowly to pink, shot with gold. Harry could hardly believe that he'd left Privet Drive only a few hours ago, that he wasn't expelled, and that he was now facing 2 completely Dursley-free weeks.
"It's been a very weird night, Hedwig," he yawned.
And without even removing his glasses, he slumped back onto his pillows and fell asleep. Chapter 4 The Leaky Cauldron. It took Harry several days to get used to his strange new freedom. Never before had he been able to get up whenever he wanted or eat whatever he fancied. He could even go wherever he pleased as long as it was in Diagon Alley. And as this long cobbled street was packed with the most fascinating wizarding shops in the world, Harry felt no desire to break his word to Fudge and stray back into the Muggle world. Harry ate breakfast each morning in the Leaky Cauldron, where he liked watching the other guests, funny little witches from the country, up for a day's shopping, venerable-looking wizards arguing over the latest article in Transfiguration Today, wild-looking warlocks, raucous dwarfs, and once what looked suspiciously like a hag who ordered a plate of raw liver from behind a thick woolen balaclava. After breakfast, Harry would go out into the backyard, take out his wand, tap the third brick from the left above the trash bin, and stand back as the archway into Diagon Alley opened in the wall. Harry spent the long sunny days exploring the shops and eating under the brightly coloured umbrellas outside cafes, where his fellow diners were showing one another their purchases.
"It's a lunascope, old boy. No more messing around with moon charts, see?"
Or else discussing the case of Sirius Black.
"Personally, I won't let any of the children out alone until he's back in Azkaban."
Harry didn't have to do his homework under the blankets by flashlight anymore. Now he could sit in the bright sunshine outside Florian Fortescue's ice cream parlour, finishing all his essays with occasional help from Florian Fortescue himself, who, apart from knowing a great deal about medieval witch burnings, gave Harry free Sundays every half an hour. Once Harry had refilled his money bag with gold galleons, silver sickles and bronze canuts from his vault at Gringotts, he had to exercise a lot of self-control not to spend the whole lot at once. He had to keep reminding himself that he had 5 years to go at Hogwarts, and how it would feel to ask the Dursleys for money for spellbooks, to stop himself from buying a handsome set of solid gold gobstones, a wizarding game rather like marbles, in which the stones squirt a nasty-smelling liquid into the other player's face when they lose a point. He was sorely tempted, too, by the perfect moving model of the galaxy in a large glass ball, which would have meant he never had to take another astronomy lesson. But the thing that tested Harry's resolution most appeared in his favourite shop, Quality Quidditch Supplies, a week after he'd arrived at the Leaky Cauldron. Curious to know what the crowd in the shop was staring at, Harry edged his way inside and squeezed in among the excited witches and wizards until he glimpsed a newly erected podium on which was mounted the most magnificent broom he had ever seen in his life.
"Just come out, prototype,"
a square-jawed wizard was telling his companion.
"It's the fastest broom in the world, isn't it, Dad?"
squeaked a boy younger than Harry, who was swinging off his father's arm.
"Irish International Sides just put in an order for 7 of these beauties," the proprietor of the shop told the crowd, "and they're favourites for the World Cup."
A large witch in front of Harry moved, and he was able to read the sign next to the broom. The Firebolt. This state-of-the-art racing broom sports a streamlined, super-fine handle of ash, treated with a diamond-hard polish and hand-numbered with its own registration number. Each individually selected birch twig in the broom tail has been honed to aerodynamic perfection, giving the Firebolt unsurpassable balance and pinpoint precision. The Firebolt has an acceleration of 150 miles an hour in 10 seconds and incorporates an unbreakable braking charm. Price on request. Price on request. Harry didn't like to think how much gold the Firebolt would cost. He had never wanted anything as much in his whole life, but he had never lost a Quidditch match on his Nimbus 2000. And what was the point in emptying his Gringotts vault for the Firebolt when he had a very good broom already? Harry didn't ask for the price, but he returned almost every day after that just to look at the Firebolt. There were, however, things that Harry needed to buy. He went to the apothecary to replenish his store of potions ingredients, and as his school robes were now several inches too short in the arm and leg, he visited Madame Malkin's robes for all occasions and bought new ones. Most important of all, he had to buy his new school books, which would include those for his two new subjects, Care of Magical Creatures and Divination. Harry got a surprise as he looked in at the bookshop window. Instead of the usual display of gold-embossed spellbooks the size of paving slabs, there was a large iron cage behind the glass that held about 100 copies of the Monster Book of Monsters. Torn pages were flying everywhere as the books grappled with each other, locked together in furious wrestling matches and snapping aggressively. Harry pulled his book list out of his pocket and consulted it for the first time. The Monster Book of Monsters was listed as the required book for care of magical creatures. Now Harry understood why Hagrid had said it would come in useful. He felt relieved. He'd been wondering whether Hagrid wanted help with some terrifying new pet. As Harry entered Flourish and Bluffs, the manager came hurrying towards him.
"Hogwarts," he said abruptly, "come to get your new books."
"Yes," said Harry, "I need—"
"Get out of the way," said the manager impatiently, brushing Harry aside.
He drew on a pair of very thick gloves, picked up a large, knobbly walking stick, and proceeded toward the door of the Monster Books cage.
"Hang on," said Harry quickly, "I've already got one of those."
"Have you?"
A look of enormous relief spread over the manager's face. "Thank heavens for that. I've been bitten 5 times already this morning."
A loud ripping noise rent the air. Two of the monster books had seized a third and were pulling it apart.
"Stop it! Stop it!" cried the manager, poking the walking stick through the bars and knocking the books apart. "I'm never stocking them again. Never. It's been bedlam. I thought we'd seen the worst when we bought 200 copies of The Invisible Book of Invisibility. Cost a fortune, and we never found them. Well, is there anything else I can help you with?"
"Yes," said Harry, looking down his book list. "I need Unfogging the Future by Cassandra Fablatsky."
"Ah, starting divination, are you?" said the manager, stripping off his gloves and leading Harry into the back of the shop, where there was a corner devoted to fortune-telling.
A small table was stacked with volumes such as Predicting the Unpredictable, Insulate Yourself Against Shocks, and Broken Balls, When Fortunes Turn Foul.
"Here you are," said the manager, who had climbed a set of steps to take down a thick black-bound book. "Unfogging the Future. Very good guide to all your basic fortune-telling methods. Palmistry, crystal balls, bird entrails."
But Harry wasn't listening. His eyes had fallen on another book, which was among a display on a small table. Death Omens. What to Do When You Know the Worst Is Coming.
"Oh, I wouldn't read that if I were you," said the manager lightly, looking to see what Harry was staring at. "You'll start seeing death omens everywhere. It's enough to frighten anyone to death."
But Harry continued to stare at the front cover of the book. It showed a black dog, large as a bear, with gleaming eyes. It looked oddly familiar. The manager pressed Unfogging the Future into Harry's hands.
"Anything else?" he said.
"Yes," said Harry, tearing his eyes away from the dogs and dazedly consulting his book list. "I need Intermediate Transfiguration and the Standard Book of Spells, Grade 3. Harry emerged from Flourish and Blotts 10 minutes later with his new books under his arms and made his way back to the Leaky Cauldron, hardly noticing where he was going and bumping into several people. He tramped up the stairs to his room, went inside, and tipped his books onto his bed. Somebody had been in to tidy. The windows were open and sun was pouring inside. Harry could hear the buses rolling by in the unseen Muggle Street behind him, and the sound of the invisible crowd below in Diagon Alley. He caught sight of himself in the mirror over the basin. "It can't have been a death omen," he told his reflection defiantly. "I was panicking when I saw that thing in Magnolia Crescent. It was probably just a stray dog." He raised his hand automatically and tried to make his hair lie flat.
"You're fighting a losing battle there, dear," said his mirror in a wheezy voice.
As the days slipped by, Harry started looking wherever he went for a sign of Ron or Hermione. Plenty of Hogwarts students were arriving in Diagon Alley now, with the start of term so near. Harry met Seamus Finnegan and Dean Thomas, his fellow Gryffindors, in Quality Quidditch Supplies, where they too were ogling the firebolt. He also ran into the real Neville Longbottom, a round-faced, forgetful boy outside Flourish and Blotts. Harry didn't stop to chat. Neville appeared to have mislaid his book list and was being told off by his very formidable-looking grandmother. Harry hoped she never found out that he'd pretended to be Neville while on the run from the Ministry of Magic. Harry woke on the last day of the holidays, thinking that he would at least meet Ron and Hermione tomorrow on the Hogwarts Express. He got up, dressed, went for a last look at the firebolt, and was just wondering where he'd have lunch when someone yelled his name and he turned. "Harry! Harry!" They were there, both of them, sitting outside Florian Fortescue's ice cream parlour, Ron looking incredibly freckly, Hermione very brown, both waving frantically at him.
"Finally," said Ron, grinning at Harry as he sat down. "We went to the Leaky Cauldron, but they said you'd left. And we went to Flourish and Blotts, and Madame Mulkin's, and..."
"I got all my school stuff last week," Harry explained. "And how come you knew I'm staying at the Leaky Cauldron?"
"Dad," said Ron simply. Mr. Weasley, who worked at the Ministry of Magic, would of course have heard the whole story of what had happened to Aunt Marge.
"Did you really blow up your aunt, Harry?"
said Hermione in a very serious voice.
"I didn't mean to," said Harry, while Ron roared with laughter. "I just lost control."
"It's not funny, Ron," said Hermione sharply. "Honestly, I'm amazed Harry wasn't expelled."
"So am I," admitted Harry. "Forget expelled. I thought I was going to be arrested."
He looked at Ron. "Your dad doesn't know why Fudge let me off, does he?"
"Probably 'cause it's you, isn't it?"
shrugged Ron, still chuckling.
"Famous Harry Potter and all that. I'd hate to see what the Ministry would do to me if I blew up an aunt. Mind you, they'd have to dig me up first because Mum would have killed me. Anyway, you can ask Dad yourself this evening. We're staying at the Leaky Cauldron tonight, too. So you can come to King's Cross with us tomorrow. Hermione's there as well."
Hermione nodded, beaming.
"Mum and Dad dropped me off this morning with all my Hogwarts things."
"Excellent," said Harry happily. "So, have you got all your new books and stuff?"
"Look at this," said Ron, pulling a long, thin box out of a bag and opening it. "Brand new wand, 14 inches, willow, containing one unicorn tail hair. And we've got all our books."
He pointed at a large bag under his chair.
"What about those monster books, eh? The assistant nearly cried when we said we wanted two."
"What's all that, Hermione?" Harry asked, pointing at not one but three bulging bags in the chair next to her.
"Well, I'm taking more new subjects than you, aren't I?" said Hermione. "Those are my books for arithmancy, care of magical creatures, divination, the study of ancient runes, muggle studies."
"What are you doing muggle studies for?"
said Ron, rolling his eyes at Harry.
"You're muggle born. Your mum and dad are muggles. You already know all about muggles."
"But it'll be fascinating to study them from a wizarding point of view," said Hermione earnestly.
"Are you planning to eat or sleep at all this year, Hermione?" asked Harry, while Ron sniggered. Hermione ignored them.
"I've still got 10 galleons, she said, checking her purse. "It's my birthday in September, and Mum and Dad gave me some money to get myself an early birthday present."
"How about a nice book?" said Ron, innocently.
"No, I don't think so," said Hermione composedly. "I really want an owl. I mean, Harry's got Hedwig and you've got Errol."
"I haven't," said Ron. "Errol's a family owl. All I've got is Scabbers."
He pulled his pet rat out of his pocket. "And I want to get him checked over," he added, placing Scabbers on the table in front of them.
"I don't think Egypt agreed with him."
Scabbers was looking thinner than usual, and there was a definite droop to his whiskers.
"There's a magical creature shop just over there," said Harry, who knew Diagon Alley very well by now. "You could see if they've got anything for Scabbers, and Hermione can get her owl."
So they paid for their ice cream and crossed the street to the magical menagerie. There wasn't much room inside. Every inch of wall was hidden by cages. It was smelly and very noisy because the occupants of these cages were all squeaking, squawking, jabbering, or hissing. The witch behind the counter was already advising a wizard on the care of double-ended newts. So Harry, Ron, and Hermione waited, examining the cages. A pair of enormous purple toads sat gulping wetly and feasting on dead blowflies. A gigantic tortoise with a jewel-encrusted shell was glittering near the window. Poisonous orange snails were oozing slowly up the side of their glass tank, and a fat white rabbit kept changing into a silk top hat and back again with a loud popping noise. Then there were cats of every colour, a noisy cage of ravens, a basket of funny, custard-coloured fur balls that were humming loudly, and on the counter a vast cage of sleek black rats that were playing some sort of skipping game using their long, bald tails. The double-ended newt wizard left, and Ron approached the counter. "It's my rat," he told the witch. "He's been a bit off-colour ever since I brought him back from Egypt."
"Bang him on the counter," said the witch, pulling a pair of heavy black spectacles out of her pocket.
Ron lifted Scabbers out of his inside pocket and placed him next to the cage of his fellow rats, who stopped their skipping tricks and scuffled to the wire for a better look. Like nearly everything Ron owned, Scabbers the rat was second-hand. He had once belonged to Ron's brother, Percy, and a bit battered. Next to the glossy rats in the cage, he looked especially woebegone.
"'Hmm,' said
the witch, picking up Scabbers.
"'How old is this rat?'
"'Dunno,' said Ron. "'Quite old. He used to belong to my brother.'
"'What powers does he have?'
said the witch, examining Scabbers closely. The truth was that Scabbers had never shown the faintest trace of interesting powers. The witch's eyes moved from Scabbers' tattered left ear to his front paw, which had a toe missing, and tuttered loudly.
"'He's been through the mill, this one,' she said.
"'He was like that when Percy gave him to me,' said Ron defensively.
"'An ordinary common or garden rat like this can't be expected to live longer than 3 years or so.'
said the witch.
"'Now, if you were looking for something a bit more hard-wearing, you might like one of these.'
She indicated the black rats, who promptly started skipping again. Ron muttered, "Show-offs."
"'Well, if you don't want a replacement, you can try this rat tonic,'
said the witch, reaching under the counter and bringing out a small red bottle. "'Okay,' said Ron. "'How much?'
"'Ouch!'
Ron buckled as something huge and orange came soaring from the top of the highest cage, landed on his head, and then propelled itself, spitting madly at Scabbers.
"'No, Crookshanks, no!'
cried the witch, but Scabbers shot from between her hands like a bar of soap, landed splay-legged on the floor, and then scampered for the door.
"'Scabbers!'
Ron shouted, racing out of the shop after him. Harry followed. It took them nearly 10 minutes to catch Scabbers, who had taken refuge under a waste paper bin outside Quality Quidditch Supplies. Ron stuffed the trembling rat back into his pocket and straightened up, massaging his head.
What was that?
It was either a very big cat or quite a small tiger, said Harry.
Where's Hermione?
Probably getting her owl. They made their way back up the crowded street to the magical menagerie. As they reached it, Hermione came out, but she wasn't carrying an owl. Her arms were clamped tightly round the enormous ginger cat.
"'You bought that monster?'
said Ron, his mouth hanging open.
"'He's gorgeous, isn't he?'
said Hermione, glowing. That was a matter of opinion, thought Harry. The cat's ginger fur was thick and fluffy, but it was definitely a bit bow-legged, and its face looked grumpy and oddly squashed, as though it had run headlong into a brick wall. Now that Scabbers was out of sight, however, the cat was purring contentedly in Hermione's arms.
"'Hermione, that thing nearly scalped me,' said Ron. "'He didn't mean to, did you, Crookshanks?'
said Hermione.
"'And what about Scabbers?'
said Ron, pointing at the lump in his chest pocket.
"'He needs rest and relaxation. How's he going to get it with that thing around?'
"'That reminds me, you forgot your rat tonic,' said Hermione, slapping the small red bottle into Ron's hand.
"'And stop worrying. Crookshanks will be sleeping in my dormitory and Scabbers in yours. What's the problem?' "'Poor Crookshanks. That witch said he'd been in there for ages. No one wanted him.'
"'I wonder why,' said Ron sarcastically, as they set off toward the leaky cauldron. They found Mr. Weasley sitting in the bar reading the Daily Prophet.
"'Harry,'
he said, smiling as he looked up,
"'how are you?'
"'Fine, thanks,' said Harry, as he, Ron, and Hermione joined Mr. Weasley with all their shopping. Mr. Weasley put down his paper, and Harry saw the now familiar picture of Sirius Black staring up at him. "They still haven't caught him, then?" he asked.
"No," said Mr. Weasley, looking extremely grave. "They've pulled us all off our regular jobs at the Ministry to try and find him, but no luck so far."
"Would we get a reward if we caught him?" asked Ron. "It'd be good to get some more money."
"Don't be ridiculous, Ron," said Mr. Weasley, who on closer inspection looked very strained. "Black's not going to be caught by a 13-year-old wizard. It's the Azkaban guards who'll get him back, you mark my words."
At that moment, Mrs. Weasley entered the bar, laden with shopping bags, and followed by the twins, Fred and George, who were about to start their fifth year at Hogwarts, the newly elected head boy, Percy, and the Weasley's youngest child, an only girl, Ginny. Ginny, who had always been very taken with Harry, seemed even more heartily embarrassed than usual when she saw him, perhaps because he had saved her life during their previous year at Hogwarts. She went very red and muttered hello, without looking at him. Percy, however, held out his hands solemnly as though he and Harry had never met and said, "Harry, how nice to see you."
"Hello, Percy," said Harry, trying not to laugh. "I hope you're well," said Percy pompously, shaking hands. It was rather like being introduced to the mayor.
"Very well, thanks."
"Harry," said Fred, elbowing Percy out of the way and bowing deeply. "Simply splendid to see you, old boy."
"Marvelous," said George, pushing Fred aside and seizing Harry's hand in turn. "Absolutely spiffing."
Percy scowled.
"That's enough now," said Mrs. Weasley.
"Mom," said Fred, as though he'd only just spotted her, and seizing her hand too. "How really corking to see you."
"I said that's enough,"
said Mrs. Weasley, depositing her shopping in an empty chair.
"Hello, Harry, dear. I suppose you've heard our exciting news."
She pointed to the brand new silver badge on Percy's chest.
"Second head boy in the family," she said, swelling with pride.
"And last," Fred muttered under his breath.
"I don't doubt that," said Mrs. Weasley, frowning suddenly. "I notice they haven't made you two prefects."
"What do we want to be prefects for?" said George, looking revolted at the very idea. "It'd take all the fun out of life."
Ginny giggled.
"You want to set a better example for your sister," snapped Mrs. Weasley.
"Ginny's got other brothers to set her an example, mother," said Percy loftily. "I'm going up to change for dinner."
He disappeared, and George heaved a sigh.
"We tried to shut him in a pyramid," he told Harry, "but Mum spotted us."
Dinner that night was a very enjoyable affair. Tom the innkeeper put three tables together in the parlour, and the seven Weasleys, Harry and Hermione, ate their way through five delicious courses.
"How are we getting to King's Cross tomorrow, Dad?"
asked Fred as they dug into a sumptuous chocolate pudding.
"The Ministry's providing a couple of cars," said Mr. Weasley.
Everybody looked up at him.
"Why?"
said Percy curiously.
"It's because of you, Perse," said George seriously, "and there'll be little flags on the hoods with HB on them for Humongous Big Head," said Fred.
Everyone except Percy and Mrs. Weasley snorted into their pudding.
"Why are the Ministry providing cars, Father?" Percy asked again in a dignified voice.
"Well, as we haven't got one any more," said Mr. Weasley, "and as I work there, they're doing me a favour."
His voice was casual, but Harry couldn't help noticing that Mr. Weasley's ears had gone red, just like Ron's did when he was under pressure.
"Good thing, too," said Mrs. Weasley briskly. "Do you realise how much luggage you've all got between you? A nice sight you'd be on the Muggle Underground. You are all packed, aren't you?"
"Ron hasn't put all his new things in his trunk yet," said Percy in a long-suffering voice. "He's dumped them on my bed."
"You'd better go and pack properly, Ron, because we won't have much time in the morning,"
Mrs. Weasley called down the table. Ron scowled at Percy.
After dinner, everyone felt very full and sleepy. One by one, they made their way upstairs to their rooms to check their things for the next day. Ron and Percy were next door to Harry. He had just closed and locked his own trunk when he heard angry voices through the wall and went to see what was going on.
The door of number 12 was ajar, and Percy was shouting, "It was here, on the bedside table. I took it off for polishing."
"I haven't touched it."
"All right," Ron roared back. "What's up?" said Harry.
"My head boy badge is gone," said Percy, rounding on Harry.
"So Scabbers rat tonic,"
said Ron, throwing things out of his trunk to look.
"I think I might have left it in the bar."
"You're not going anywhere till you found my badge," yelled Percy.
"I'll get Scabbers stuff. I'm packed,"
Harry said to Ron, and he went downstairs. Harry was halfway along the passage to the bar, which was now very dark, when he heard another pair of angry voices coming from the parlour. A second later, he recognised them as Mr. and Mrs. Weasley's. He hesitated, not wanting them to know he'd heard them arguing, when the sound of his own name made him stop, then move closer to the parlour door.
"Makes no sense not to tell him," Mr. Weasley was saying heatedly.
"Harry's got a right to know. I've tried to tell Fudge, but he insists on treating Harry like a child. He's 13 years old and..."
"Arthur, the truth would terrify him,"
said Mrs. Weasley shrilly.
"Do you really want to send Harry back to school with that hanging over him? For heaven's sake, he's happy not knowing."
"I don't want to make him miserable. I want to put him on his guard," retorted Mr. Weasley. "You know what Harry and Ron are like, wandering off by themselves. They've ended up in the Forbidden Forest twice. But Harry mustn't do that this year, when I think what could have happened to him that night he ran away from home. If the night bus hadn't picked him up, I'm prepared to bet he would have been dead before the ministry found him."
"But he's not dead. He's fine. So what's the point?"
"Molly, they say Sirius Black's mad, and maybe he is. But he was clever enough to escape from Azkaban, and that's supposed to be impossible. It's been 3 weeks, and no one's seen hide nor hair of him, and I don't care what Fudge keeps telling the Daily Prophet. We're no nearer catching Black than inventing self-spelling wands. The only thing we know for sure is what Black's after."
"But Harry will be perfectly safe at Hogwarts."
"We thought Azkaban was perfectly safe. If Black can break out of Azkaban, he can break into Hogwarts."
"But no one's really sure that Black's after Harry."
There was a thud on wood, and Harry was sure Mr. Weasley had banged his fist on the table.
"Molly, how many times do I have to tell you? They didn't report it in the press because Fudge wanted it kept quiet. But Fudge went out to Azkaban the night Black escaped. The guards told Fudge that Black's been talking in his sleep for a while now. Always the same words. He's at Hogwarts. He's at Hogwarts. Black is deranged, Molly, and he wants Harry dead. If you ask me, he thinks murdering Harry will bring you-know-who back to power. Black lost everything the night Harry stopped you-know-who, and he's had 12 years alone in Azkaban to brood on that."
There was a silence. Harry leaned still closer to the door, desperate to hear more.
"Well, Arthur, you must do what you think is right, but you're forgetting Albus Dumbledore. I don't think anything could hurt Harry at Hogwarts while Dumbledore's headmaster. I suppose he knows about all this."
"Of course he knows. We had to ask him if he minds the Azkaban guards stationing themselves around the entrances to the school grounds. He wasn't happy about it, but he agreed."
"Not happy? Why shouldn't he be happy if they're there to catch Black?"
"Dumbledore isn't fond of the Azkaban guards," said Mr. Weasley heavily. "Nor am I, if it comes to that. But when you're dealing with a wizard like Black, you sometimes have to join forces with those you'd rather avoid.
If they save Harry,
then I will never say another word against them," said Mr. Weasley wearily. "It's late, Molly. We'd better go up."
Harry heard chairs move. As quietly as he could, he hurried down the passage to the bar and out of sight. The parlour door opened, and a few seconds later footsteps told him that Mr. and Mrs. Weasley were climbing the stairs. The bottle of rat tonic was lying under the table they had sat at earlier. Harry waited until he heard Mr. and Mrs. Weasley's bedroom door close, then headed back upstairs with the bottle. Fred and George were crouching in the shadows on the landing, heaving with laughter as they listened to Percy dismantling his and Ron's room in search of his badge.
"We've got it," Fred whispered to Harry. "We've been improving it."
The badge now read, "Big Head Boy." Harry forced a laugh, went to give Ron the rat tonic, then shut himself in his room and lay down on his bed. So Sirius Black was after him. This explained everything. Fudge had been lenient with him because he was so relieved to find him alive. He'd made Harry promise to stay in Diagon Alley where there were plenty of wizards to keep an eye on him, and he was sending 2 ministry cars to take them all to the station tomorrow so that the Weasleys could look after Harry until he was on the train. Harry lay listening to the muffled shouting next door and wondered why he didn't feel more scared. Sirius Black had murdered 13 people with one curse. Mr. and Mrs. Weasley obviously thought Harry would be panic-stricken if he knew the truth. But Harry happened to agree wholeheartedly with Mrs. Weasley that the safest place on earth was wherever Albus Dumbledore happened to be. Didn't people always say that Dumbledore was the only person Lord Voldemort had ever been afraid of? Surely Black, as Voldemort's right-hand man, would be just as frightened of him. And then there were these Azkaban guards everyone kept talking about. They seemed to scare most people senseless, and if they were stationed all around the school, Black's chances of getting inside seemed very remote. No, all in all, the thing that bothered Harry most was the fact that his chances of visiting Hogsmeade now looked like zero. Nobody would want Harry to leave the safety of the castle until Black was caught. In fact, Harry suspected his every move would be carefully watched until the danger had passed. He scowled at the dark ceiling. Did they think he couldn't look after himself? He'd escaped Lord Voldemort 3 times. He wasn't completely useless. Unbidden, the image of the beast in the shadows of Magnolia Crescent crossed his mind. What to do when you know the worst is coming? I'm not going to be murdered, Harry said out loud.
That's the spirit, dear, said his mirror sleepily.
Chapter 5 The Dementor. Tom woke Harry the next morning with his usual toothless grin and a cup of tea. Harry got dressed and was just persuading a disgruntled Hedwig to get back into her cage when Ron banged his way into the room, pulling a sweatshirt over his head and looking irritable.
"The sooner we get on the train, the better," he said. "At least I can get away from Percy at Hogwarts. Now he's accusing me of dripping tea on his photo of Penelope Clearwater, you know."
Ron grimaced.
His girlfriend. She's hidden her face under the frame because her nose has gone all blotchy.
I've got something to tell you, Harry began, but they were interrupted by Fred and George, who had looked in to congratulate Ron on infuriating Percy again. They headed down to breakfast, where Mr. Weasley was reading the front page of the Daily Prophet with a furrowed brow, and Mrs. Weasley was telling Hermione and Ginny about a love potion she'd made as a young girl. All 3 of them were rather giggly.
"What were you saying?"
Ron asked Harry as they sat down.
"Later,"
Harry muttered as Percy stormed in. Harry had no chance to speak to Ron or Hermione in the chaos of leaving. They were too busy heaving all their trunks down the leaky cauldron's narrow staircase and piling them up near the door with Hedwig and Hermes, Percy's screech owl, perched on top in their cages. A small wickerwork basket stood beside the heap of trunks, spitting loudly.
"It's all right, Cookshanks,"
Hermione cooed through the wickerwork.
"I'll let you out on the train."
"You won't," snapped Ron. "What about poor Scabbers, eh?" He pointed at his chest, where a large lump indicated that Scabbers was curled up in his pocket. Mr. Weasley, who'd been outside waiting for the ministry cars, stuck his head inside. "They're here," he said. "Harry, come on." Mr. Weasley marched Harry across the short stretch of pavement towards the first of 2 old-fashioned dark green cars, each of which was driven by a furtive-looking wizard wearing a suit of emerald velvet. "In you get, Harry," said Mr. Weasley, glancing up and down the crowded street. Harry got into the back of the car and was shortly joined by Hermione, Ron, and, to Ron's disgust, Percy. The journey to King's Cross was very uneventful compared with Harry's trip on the night bus. The Ministry of Magic cars seemed almost ordinary, though Harry noticed that they could slide through gaps that Uncle Vernon's new company car certainly couldn't have managed. They reached King's Cross with 20 minutes to spare. The ministry drivers found them trolleys, unloaded their trunks, touched their hats in salute to Mr. Weasley, and drove away, somehow managing to jump to the head of an unmoving line at the traffic lights.
Mr. Weasley kept close to Harry's elbow all the way into the station.
"Right then," he said, glancing around them. "Let's do this in pairs, as there are so many of us. I'll go through first with Harry."
Mr. Weasley strolled toward the barrier between platforms 9 and 10, pushing Harry's trolley, and apparently very interested in the Intercity 125 that had just arrived at platform 9. With a meaningful look at Harry, he leaned casually against the barrier. Harry imitated him. In a moment, they had fallen sideways through the solid metal onto platform 9 3/4 and looked up to see the Hogwarts Express, a scarlet steam engine puffing smoke over a platform packed with witches and wizards seeing their children onto the train. Percy and Ginny suddenly appeared behind Harry. They were panting and had apparently taken the barrier at a run.
"Ah, there's Penelope,"
said Percy, smoothing his hair and going pink again. Ginny caught Harry's eye, and they both turned away to hide their laughter as Percy strode over to a girl with long, curly hair, walking with his chest thrown out so that she couldn't miss his shiny badge. Once the remaining Weasleys and Hermione had joined them, Harry and Ron led the way to the end of the train, past packed compartments, to a carriage that looked quite empty. They loaded the trunks onto it, stowed Hedwig and Crookshanks in the luggage rack, then went back outside to say goodbye to Mr. and Mrs. Weasley. Mrs. Weasley kissed all her children, then Hermione, and finally Harry. He was embarrassed, but really quite pleased when she gave him an extra hug.
"Do take care, won't you, Harry?"
she said as she straightened up, her eyes oddly bright. Then she opened her enormous handbag and said,
"I've made you all sandwiches. Here you are, Ron. No, they're not corned beef. Fred, where's Fred? Here you are, dear."
"Harry," said Mr. Weasley quietly, "come over here a moment."
He jerked his head toward a pillar, and Harry followed him behind it, leaving the others crowded round Mrs. Weasley.
"There's something I've got to tell you before you leave," said Mr. Weasley in a tense voice.
"It's all right, Mr. Weasley," said Harry. "I already know."
"You know? How could you know?"
I heard you and Mrs. Weasley talking last night. I couldn't help hearing," Harry added quickly. "Sorry."
"That's not the way I'd have chosen for you to find out," said Mr. Weasley, looking anxious.
"No, honestly, it's okay. This way you haven't broken your word to Fudge, and I know what's going on."
"Harry, you must be very scared."
"I'm not," said Harry sincerely. "Really?"
he added, because Mr. Weasley was looking disbelieving.
"I'm not trying to be a hero, but seriously, Sirius Black can't be worse than Voldemort, can he?"
Mr. Weasley flinched at the sound of the name, but overlooked it.
"Harry, I knew you were, well, made of stronger stuff than Fudge seems to think, and I'm obviously pleased that you're not scared, but..."
"Arthur!"
called Mrs. Weasley, who was now shepherding the rest onto the train.
"Arthur, what are you doing? It's about to go."
"He's coming, Molly,"
said Mr. Weasley, but he turned back to Harry and kept talking in a low and more hurried voice.
"Listen, I want you to give me your word."
"That I'll be a good boy and stay in the castle," said Harry gloomily.
"Not entirely," said Mr. Weasley, who looked more serious than Harry had ever seen him. "Harry, swear to me you won't go looking for Black."
Harry stared.
"What?"
There was a loud whistle. Guards were walking along the train, slamming all the doors shut.
"Promise me, Harry," said Mr. Weasley, talking more quickly still, "that whatever happens..."
"Why would I go looking for someone I know wants to kill me?"
said Harry blankly.
"Swear to me that whatever you might hear..."
"Arthur, quickly!"
cried Mrs. Weasley. Steam was billowing from the train. It had started to move. Harry ran to the compartment door and Ron threw it open and stood back to let him on. They leaned out of the window and waved to Mr. and Mrs. Weasley until the train turned a corner and blocked them from view.
"I need to talk to you in private,"
Harry muttered to Ron and Hermione as the train picked up speed.
"Go away, Ginny,"
said Ron.
"Oh, that's nice,"
said Ginny huffily, and she stalked off. Harry, Ron and Hermione set off down the corridor looking for an empty compartment, but all were full except for the one at the very end of the train. This had only one occupant, a man sitting fast asleep next to the window. Harry, Ron and Hermione checked on the threshold. The Hogwarts Express was usually reserved for students, and they had never seen an adult there before, except for the witch who pushed the food cart. The stranger was wearing an extremely shabby set of wizard's robes that had been darned in several places. He looked ill and exhausted. Though quite young, his light brown hair was flecked with grey.
"Who do you reckon he is?"
Ron hissed as they sat down and slid the door shut, taking the seats farthest away from the window.
"Professor R.J. Lupin,"
whispered Hermione at once. "How do you know that?"
"It's on his case,"
she replied, pointing at the luggage rack over the man's head, where there was a small, battered case held together with a large quantity of neatly knotted string. The name Professor R.J. Lupin was stamped across one corner in peeling letters.
"Wonder what he teaches,"
said Ron, frowning at Professor Lupin's pallid profile.
"That's obvious," whispered Hermione. "There's only one vacancy, isn't there? Defense against the Dark Arts."
Harry, Ron, and Hermione had already had two Defense Against the Dark Arts teachers, both of whom had lasted only 1 year. There were rumors that the job was jinxed.
"Well, I hope he's up to it," said Ron doubtfully. "He looks like one good hex would finish him off, doesn't he? Anyway,"
he turned to Harry,
"what were you going to tell us?"
Harry explained all about Mr. and Mrs. Weasley's argument and the warning Mr. Weasley had just given him. When he'd finished, Ron looked thunderstruck, and Hermione had her hands over her mouth. She finally lowered them to say,
"Sirius Black escaped to come after you? Ooh, Harry, you have to be really, really careful. Don't go looking for trouble, Harry."
"I don't go looking for trouble," said Harry nettled. "Trouble usually finds me."
"How thick would Harry have to be to go looking for a nutter who wants to kill him?" said Ron shakily.
They were taking the news worse than Harry had expected. Both Ron and Hermione seemed to be much more frightened of Black than he was.
"No one knows how he got out of Azkaban," said Ron uncomfortably. "No one's ever done it before, and he was a top security prisoner, too."
"But they'll catch him, won't they?" said Hermione earnestly.
"I mean, they've got all the muggles looking out for him, too."
"What's that noise?" said Ron suddenly. A faint, tinny sort of whistle was coming from somewhere. They looked all around the compartment.
"It's coming from your trunk, Harry," said Ron, standing up and reaching into the luggage rack.
A moment later, he had pulled the pocket sneaker scope out from between Harry's robes. It was spinning very fast in the palm of Ron's hand and glowing brilliantly.
"Is that a sneaker scope?"
said Hermione interestedly, standing up for a better look.
"Yeah, mind you, it's a very cheap one," Ron said. "It went haywire just as I was tying it to Errol's leg to send it to Harry." "Were you doing anything untrustworthy at the time?" said Hermione shrewdly.
"No. Well, I wasn't supposed to be using Errol. You know he's not really up to long journeys. But how else was I supposed to get Harry's present to him?" "Stick it back in the trunk," Harry advised as the sneaker scope whistled piercingly, "or it'll wake him up." He nodded towards Professor Lupin. Ron stuffed the sneaker scope into a particularly horrible pair of Uncle Vernon's old socks, which deadened the sound, then closed the lid of the trunk on it.
"We could get it checked in Hogsmeade," said Ron, sitting back down. "They sell that sort of thing in Dervish and Banjis, magical instruments and stuff. Fred and George told me."
"Do you know much about Hogsmeade?" asked Hermione keenly.
"I've read it's the only entirely non-Muggle settlement in Britain."
"Yeah, I think it is," said Ron, in an offhand sort of way.
"But that's not why I want to go. I just want to get inside Honeydukes."
"What's that?"
said Hermione. "It's this sweet shop," said Ron,
a dreamy look coming over his face,
"where they've got everything. Pepper imps, they make you smoke at the mouth, and great fat chocoballs full of strawberry mousse and clotted cream, and really excellent sugar quills, which you can suck in class and just look like you're thinking what to write next."
"But Hogsmeade's a very interesting place, isn't it?"
Hermione pressed on eagerly.
"In Sites of Historical Sorcery, it says the inn was the headquarters for the 1612 Goblin Rebellion, and the Shrieking Shack's supposed to be the most severely haunted building in Britain. And massive sherbet balls that make you levitate a few inches off the ground while you're sucking them," said Ron, who was plainly not listening to a word Hermione was saying.
Hermione looked around at Harry.
"Won't it be nice to get out of school for a bit and explore Hogsmeade?"
"'Spect it will," said Harry heavily. "You'll have to tell me when you've found out."
"What do you mean?" said Ron.
"I can't go. The Dursleys didn't sign my permission form, and Fudge wouldn't either." Ron looked horrified.
You're not allowed to come? But no way. McGonagall or someone will give you permission.
Harry gave a hollow laugh. Professor McGonagall, head of Gryffindor House, was very strict.
Or we can ask Fred and George. They know every secret passage out of the castle. Ron, said Hermione sharply, I don't think Harry should be sneaking out of school with Black on the loose.
Yeah, I expect that's what McGonagall will say.